Rome has long been a prime destination for tourists, from backpackers to religious pilgrims. Recently, city officials decreed that all hotels, even campsites, must impose a new tax on travelers. And as NPR's Silvia Pagioli reports from the Italian capital, hotel owners are furious.
There's a carnival atmosphere in Rome at the end of the Christmas holidays when Romans and tourists flock to Piazza Navona. Reggie Mudd from Nashville, Tennessee, is snapping photos of the crowds and Baroque fountains. He has heard about the new hotel tax, but he's unfazed about the extra cost.
I mean, coming to Italy is expensive, you know, to begin with. So a little bit more, I mean, are you not going to come because of it? I don't think so.
However, Italian tourist Giorgio Severini, visiting with his family of four, is angry.
I guess we have to pay, but I don't know whether it's justified. And in any case, they should have warned us ahead of time.
The hotel tax went into effect January 1st. It varies according to the type of accommodation. Each person over the age of 10 has to pay from an extra €1 a night at campsites and bed and breakfast to €3, that's about $4 a night, at luxury hotels. The Rome City Council estimates it will raise more than $100 million a year, and it promises to use the funds to remove some of the city's major shortcomings and offer better services. That's a tall order. Roman traffic is so bad it even drowns out church bells, and walking in this city is a feat not for the faint-hearted. Pedestrians have to elbow their way through thousands of cars parked along narrow streets and watch out not to sprain their ankles on ever-present potholes and broken cobblestones. Francesca Corsetti, concierge at a three-star hotel in central Rome, says her client's number one complaint is about the poor quality of public transportation.
Sicuramente non coglie il plauso della gente, molto disappunto.
No one is happy about this tax, that's for sure, both because it's steep and because nobody knows whether services will really improve.
Tourism is Italy's number one industry, and Rome is arguably the cradle of modern tourism. Its ancient ruins and Renaissance artworks have attracted visitors for centuries. Rome was the focal point of the required educational grand tour, as conceived by writers such as Goethe, Stendhal, and Henry James. This may be why Romans tend to take for granted the annual tourist onslaught and have done little to make the city more welcoming. Independent tour operator Giorgio Sansa is worried. He says Italy is already losing ground to Spain, Greece, and Turkey, which are much cheaper.
We are too expensive. We don't realize that we need tourism. We have so much to offer. We have so much to show. We have some of the best cuisines in the world. We have culture, arts, but that's not enough. We have also to watch our prices because people are looking for the good bargain.
But the cash-strapped Rome City Council is undeterred. Not only has it imposed a hotel tax, tourists visiting city-owned museums are now being charged €1 more than residents. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
The rise of the smartphone has made it easy to access the internet anytime, anywhere. And one of the most popular destinations is Wikipedia, which turns 10 years old this week. The free online encyclopedia that anyone can edit has become part of our cultural fabric. We called out to our fans on Facebook and followers on Twitter and asked them to tell us the most interesting thing they learned through Wikipedia.
I found out that an old boyfriend of mine had been named the Minister of the Interior in Greece.
Switzerland is roughly the size of San Bernardino County in Southern California.
The Stoic Greek philosopher Chrysippus, I think is how you pronounce it, actually died of laughing.
If I'm looking at a squirrel and I wonder, well, why is the squirrel doing this, or what kind of squirrel is that? I'll go on Wikipedia.
Wikipedia played an integral part in me believing in transubstantiation. Once a person believes in transubstantiation, the Catholic Church really is your only choice. So in a not-so-roundabout way, Wikipedia really kind of forced me to become Catholic.
The legend of the cactus cat, which is a prickly cat-like beast who cuts open cacti and drinks the fermented juice, becomes drunk, and howls through the night.
That was Ashley Sapp of Indiana, along with Devin Casper of North Dakota, Cheryl Gauthier in Utah, Melvin Davis III in Georgia, and Josh Wynn of California. For more on Wikipedia's first decade, here's NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin.
So in that montage, you heard from Melvin Davis III.
Well, why are these squirrels black on one side of town? Why are they brown on the other side of town?
Davis is a sophomore at Morehouse College in Atlanta. He says in high school, his teachers told him never to use Wikipedia.
But now professors are saying things like, if you can find another reputable source to back up what you find on Wikipedia, that's completely fine.
Still, teachers and librarians tend to be leery of the site. I walked upstairs to talk to NPR's own reference librarian, Key Molesky.
I kind of, as a professional researcher, question the value of using a site like that when you don't have the basic trust that the information is accurate and up-to-date and dependable.
Key even keeps a running document of the site's flubs. She's not absolutely opposed to the concept of a free encyclopedia and says it can be a good starting place for reference links or to get the gist of a topic.
But I don't know how you deal with the fact that anyone can, and unfortunately often does, insert incorrect material for what appear to be malicious reasons.
Andrew Lee is a journalism professor at the University of Southern California and wrote the book The Wikipedia Revolution. He says about 5 years ago, there was a perfect storm. Wikipedia began saturating Google results, and several high-profile errors forced Wikipedia to pull back from their completely free and open editing policy. That has cut down on some of the problems, but the site is still inherently unreliable. Lee says, given that, most people find the site's articles to be more reliable than they expect, and Wikipedia has spawned a new skepticism.
People started to look at how reliable Britannica was and start to really fact-check their articles. They start to look at, should we be trusting the New York Times as much? Even NPR, BBC, these kind of folks.
A British journal studied the site's reliability in 2005. It found that in science articles, Wikipedia had an average of 4 errors, while Britannica had an average of 3, a finding that Britannica has fervently contested. Lee says the English language Wikipedia has plateaued at 3.5 million articles, and looking forward, the site needs to figure out how to keep expanding. One way to do that is by funding programs that move Wikipedia's content off the net.
Whether it's by DVD or CD, by mobiles, by printed matter.
So imagine the future of Wikipedia in a book, on your lap. How retro. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News.
Okay, so our listeners say they use Wikipedia to learn about everything from the Smurfs to the Hells Angels. And you can join that discussion online at NPR.org and also on our Facebook page. This is NPR News.
A new housing study offers a grim forecast for some parts of the West. It says areas hit hardest by home foreclosures may never fully recover. As NPR's Karen Grigsby-Bates reports, that raises big questions about the future of some neighborhoods that sprang up during boom times.
This is something that's happening way too infrequently these days.
Cedar-lined closets, lots of built-ins. Fabulous walk-in pantry over there, Butler's pantry.
That's realtor Jody Velto showing potential clients a vacant single-family home in Upland. It's in San Bernardino County, one of California's hardest hit, and like everywhere else, Upland's prices dipped in the past few years. Now buyers slowly are coming back, looking for amenities like these her husband Bill, also a broker, is outlining.
Granite countertops, travertine flooring, stainless steel appliances.
Bill Velto says this neighborhood has fared comparatively well because of its location just east of L.A. County. It's a reasonable commute, and for some, the price makes the drive worth it.
Well, you know, back in the old day, it was go west, my friend, go west. Now it's kind of go east, my friend, go east, because of the values.
This house, which listed a few years ago for well over $700,000, sold that day for around $500,000. But in many parts of the country, a sale like this is the exception to the rule. A new study commissioned by the Mortgage Bankers Association's Research Institute for Housing America looked at how plummeting real estate values are dragging down several American cities.
The story's not over, but my sense is that the demand drop is significant and persistent, and for some of these places, it'll be a long time before they fully recover.
Jim Follain, an economist and senior fellow at the Rockefeller Institute of Government in Albany, authored the study. He says the current housing downturn is reminiscent of the erosion of several industrial cities in the North and Midwest.
Well, I think we believe there might be some insights about the current situation by looking at what I call traditional declining cities, which you think about some of the places in the Rust Belt.
In other words, Stockton, California, and parts of Fresno and many newly built desert communities in Arizona and Nevada seem to be headed where Detroit is now, full of housing that is standing empty. Anne Fullane says, just as it's taken decades for some Rust Belt cities to recover, the same could be true of parts of the country that have suffered severe housing slumps. The current housing mess has adversely affected the American economy for the long term, says John Wasik, author of a book called The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome.
I think the real estate market, at least in residential areas, in some of the worst-hit areas, especially in, say, Central and Southern California, are going to be hobbled for at least a generation.
Which means no silver lining in the black cloud hanging over housing. It's a grim forecast, especially for many new developments that sprang up during the boom times. Whole communities were constructed on the field of dreams expectation that if you build it, they will come, especially when financing a house was about as easy as financing a car. Those days are long gone, but John Wasik says hard-hit areas will continue to pay a huge price for those easy money mortgages.
Many people finance without any down payment at all. So those are the people who had no economic stake whatsoever in staying in those properties and subsequently became part of the foreclosure process.
Today, it's possible to find a good deal where there used to be none. But the uncertainty of where prices are headed makes buyers and lenders hesitant, which deepens the problem, says economist Jim Fullane.
And that's the fear, I think, that, will my neighborhood be one that is going to be particularly slow to recover.
Being able to choose a neighborhood that will thrive may mean life or death for a number of American cities going forward. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Every January for the past decade, you've heard the same news story, that the last year was one of the warmest on the planet since 1880, when record-keeping began in earnest. Well, it's January. And yes, last year was one of the warmest since 1880. In fact, 2010 ties 2005 for the hottest year in the historical record. NPR's Richard Harris has the latest edition of this story.
This year, it was Deke Arndt's turn to break the news in the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's annual teleconference. And you already know what he announced.
This continues a trend that has gone on for several decades. This is the 34th consecutive year with temperatures above the 20th century average.
In fact, you need to go back to 1976 to find a year with below average global temperatures, as measured on thermometers around the world. But enough about heat already. What about rain and snow?
Precipitation is highly variable from place to place, so there were lots of dry areas, lots of wet areas, but when we average those out, it was also the wettest year on record.
Think of the devastating floods in Pakistan. Now, warm air can hold more water, but Arndt can't say whether there's a direct link between the record-tying heat and the record-breaking precipitation. And these are global averages. Arndt said the story was different for those of us in the United States.
Both the temperature and precipitation were above normal. It was the 23rd warmest year on record in the United States. It was the 36th wettest year on record. These both fall into the upper third of the United States climate history, which dates back to 1895.
Of course, there's a lot of variation across the globe, so it's not at all surprising to see records in some places, but not in others. Last year's global record was due in part to an unusually hot Pacific Ocean caused by a weather pattern called El Niño. John Christie at the University of Alabama in Huntsville sees the same general warming trend in his measurements of global temperature. Those are based on satellite measurements of the planet's air from the surface up to 35,000 feet.
Well, the take-home lesson is if you have an El Niño, you're going to have a hot year. But I just finished shoveling 8 inches of global warming off my driveway this Monday here in Alabama. So whatever the globe is doing, your local weather can have a completely different picture, that's for sure.
And as for the long-term global trend, David Easterling from the National Climatic Data Center in Asheville, North Carolina, says that's our doing, global warming, driven by our emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases.
Although we can't attribute any individual event, such as the Russian heat wave, to climate change, it's always important to keep in mind that the probability of these kinds of events do increase as the climate warms.
And yes, that's the same conclusion you heard from the world's most respected climate scientists in 2010, 2009, 2008, and so on. The story's not changing. Richard Harris, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. When it comes to pop culture, the happy ending seems to rule these days. Well, we are going to look back now at a book that reveled in struggle. It is Hubert Selby Jr.'s Last Exit to Brooklyn. Author Mishnah Wolf fell in love with the book because of the harshness of its characters' lives. Here she is to explain why you must read this.
There are a lot of books I'd like to tell you I always reach for, books I'm supposed to love. But the one I actually always have by my side is Last Exit to Brooklyn by Hubert Selby Jr. I don't know why this is my book. As a girlfriend said, why would you recommend that book to people? I know, it's graphic, it's violent, but I've purchased Last Exit to Brooklyn 3 times now because I've mistakenly given it to a friend or put it in storage like an idiot, thinking I could live without it. I can't. Selby Jr.'s voice always draws me in. He writes in Brooklyn street slang and doesn't delineate between what his characters think and what they say. The result in Last Exit is somewhere between poetry and profanity. The book itself is set in the 50s in an area of Brooklyn so harsh that any sign of weakness is met with violence. So the dialogue reflects the type of neighborhood where someone might rape you or beat you half to death because they don't like the way you walk. There is Harry, the closeted strike leader, who uses union petty cash to discover the world of drag queens. Tra-la-la, the money-hungry young girl who sees her bust as a ticket to a better life and is completely shameless about it. And Georgette, the transvestite who's in love with a young neighborhood criminal and imagines herself always closer to her goal of becoming his exclusive girlfriend. They are not the kind of characters you normally root for. They're too flawed in very destructive ways. It's like rooting for the schoolyard bully because you found out that when he's not slamming people into lockers, he likes butterflies. The beauty of Last Exit is that against the odds, these characters are reaching. So as much as you're revolted by their flaws, you also start to see them as the product of their own fight against this neighborhood. In that way, the neighborhood becomes a character, the antagonist out to crush hope. And Selby Jr.'s characters try so hard to defeat that antagonist. They love, they dream, they try to transcend their lot, and they fail and are beaten down. But surprisingly, it feels life-affirming, as though that thing that makes them try is some basic life force that cannot be killed no matter how depraved an environment it lives in, the will to survive. And there's something inspiring about their courage to stand for themselves in this cruel neighborhood and say, I'm here, this is me, I am here.
Mishnah Wolf's latest book is called I'm Down, a Memoir. She picked Last Exit to Brooklyn by Hubert Selby Jr. for our series You Must Read This. Tonight in Tucson, President Obama attends a memorial for those who died in Saturday's shooting. Daniel Hernandez has emerged from the tragedy a hero. He was a new intern who rushed to the aid of Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords after she'd been shot.
The first thing I did was to pick her up and prop her up against my chest to make sure that she could breathe properly. Once I was sure that she was able to breathe properly and wouldn't asphyxiate, the next thing I did was to apply pressure to her wound to make sure that we could stem the blood loss.
The Latino community is especially proud of Daniel Hernandez, and some say they are also relieved. Writer Daisy Hernandez, no relation to Daniel, has this reflection.
I wasn't the only person on Saturday who rushed to her Android when news came of the Tucson shooting. I wasn't looking, however, to read about what had happened. My auntie had already filled me in. Someone tried to murder una representante. People have been killed, she reported. What I wanted to know was the killer's surname. My eyes scanned the mobile papers. I held my breath. Finally, I saw it. Jared Loughner, not a Ramirez, Gonzalez, or Garcia. It's safe to say there was a collective sigh of brown relief when the Tucson killer turned out to be a gringo. Had the shooter been Latino, media pundits wouldn't be discussing the impact of nasty politics on a young man this week. They'd be demanding an even more stringent anti-immigrant policy. The new members of the House would be stepping over each other to propose new legislation for more guns on the border, more mothers to be deported, and more employers to be penalized for hiring brown people. Obama would be attending funerals and telling the nation tonight that he was going to increase security just about everywhere. In short, the only reason the nation is taking a few days to reflect on the animosity in politics is precisely because the shooter was not Latino. It's painfully ironic that a gay Latino man came to the aid of Representative Giffords in the storm of gunfire. If a judge hadn't blocked provisions of Arizona's SB 1070 law, however, the intern's surname would have easily qualified him as a target for police under different circumstances on Saturday. As Sheriff Clarence Dupnik of Pima County, Arizona, told reporters, "The anger, the hatred, the bigotry that goes on in this country is getting to be outrageous. And unfortunately, Arizona has become sort of the capital." I admit that it was only after I saw the shooter's gringo surname that I was able to go on and read the rest of the news about those who lost their lives on Saturday and those who, like Representative Giffords, were severely wounded. I admit also that I felt some small relief in knowing that at least this shooting wouldn't be used as a reason for yet another backlash against immigrants. Or at least that's what I'm hoping. In this political climate, it's hard to tell.
Daisy Hernandez is the co-editor of Colonize This, Young Women on Today's Feminism.
This is NPR.